I am Platt on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. A new memoir has just been published from the distinguished author and academic J. Edward Chamberlain, The Banker and the Blackfoot, a memoir of my grandfather in Chinook country. It's about the time at the end of the 19th and the turn of the 20th century in what would come to be known as Alberta, where his grandfather Jack and Crop-Eared Wolf meet and develop a remarkable friendship. I just started it, and it gives us insight into this almost unknown place and unpredictable time. We learn of the motivations that bring Jack to this part of the world and the struggles faced by the Blackfoot as they exercise their sovereignty and see the First Nations treaties broken. We go to the Fort McLeod of 1885 to 1905 and get a sense of the promise and reality of the era. I'll get Mr. Chamberlain, who joins me now, to tell us as much as he likes about this book, these men, the people around them, their stories. What this book also illuminates is what's possible in Canada. J. Edward Chamberlain's previous books include The Harrowing of Eden, White Attitudes Towards Native Americans, Come Back to Me, My Language, and Horse. His book, If This Is Your Land, Where Are Your Stories, was a finalist for the Charles Taylor Prize and the Pearson Writers Trust Award. He is Professor Emeritus of English and Comparative Literature at the University of Toronto, an Officer of the Order of Canada, and lives in Half Moon Bay, British Columbia. He joins me from Vancouver today. This new book is published by Knopf. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Ted Chamberlain. Professor Chamberlain, good morning.
Good morning. Very nice to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So for people who might not know Alberta well, would you place geographically where Chinook country is?
Certainly. It's the area south of Calgary in the foothills of the Rockies and stretching down to the American border, and indeed the country that I'm talking about moves down into Montana as well. And in the late 19th century, that border wasn't as nearly as fixed or as sure as it is now. Several things about that country. It's grassland, high plains country. It's the northern reach of the great buffalo herds that had covered the plains for thousands of years and that were sadly disappearing in the latter part of the 19th century, and by 1880 had really gone from the plains. It's also the country of these extraordinary Chinook winds caused by a particular sort of weather pattern that brings the air down from the mountains, and it warms as it falls, and in the middle of winter, a Chinook wind can raise the temperature by as much as 50 degrees overnight. So it's a blessing in the middle of a cold snap. It's also a hazard because it can flood the rivers, and then a freeze up after can cause all kinds of confusion. That's the country. It was in the 1880s, the country where the Blackfoot, it was Blackfoot territory, still is Blackfoot territory, where they had been for time immemorial, and their ancestors, and it was the place where the Northwest Mounted Police went the furthest west and settled in Fort McLeod, the settlement, the post named after James McLeod, who was commissioner of the Mounted Police at the time.
Yeah, and so in the mid 1880s. Jack, your grandfather, was coming from where, and why did he end up there?
Well, he had gone with his brother to Pile of Bones, it was called, just in Saskatchewan. Pile of Bones changed its name to Regina in 1882, just after he got there. They homesteaded there, stayed there for 3 years, built a sod house for themselves. They had good fortune there. But the winters were brutally cold, down 50 below. And they'd heard about those Chinook winds and the foothills. They also heard about the ranching that was taking hold there. As the buffalo had gone, the ranches came in, and it was the same grasslands, great cattle country. And they thought there would be opportunities out there, so they got in a wagon and headed out to Fort McLeod.
And then to take this story further, I guess... he spends his time there, and then the end of his life was here in Vancouver, is that right?
Yes, came out to Vancouver in 1910, 1911, and settled into Vancouver for the rest of his life. He lived until 1947, became part of the history of the development of Vancouver, and indeed spent time in the interior as well. But he was a West Coaster, sailed up and down the coast, both in sailboats and in motor launch that he bought, and sailed right up to Alaska and that, lots of times with my mom.
Yeah.
So the latter part of his life was there, but the part that I write about is the time from 1885 through until around 1910, 1905, 1910.
Yeah.
1905 is a crucial moment because it's when the Northwest Territories were split into the two provinces of Alberta and Saskatchewan.
Now, Jack meets Crop-Eared Wolf when?
In 1885, 1886, right in that next round, right in there. And Crop-Eared Wolf is the son of Red Crow, who was the great Kainai blood tribe leader. The Blackfoot is a confederacy of the Bloods, the Kainai, the Piegan, and the Siksika. And the Bloods, their home territory was right in the area around Fort McLeod and Pincher Creek, about 90 miles south of Calgary.
And I mean, would it be safe to say that they hit it off right away when they met?
They seemed to have.
Yeah.
Yeah, by all counts, they did. An unlikely friendship, a fast friendship. They in that it took hold quickly, but it also stayed with them throughout Crop-Eared Wolf's life, and indeed, in its own way, throughout all of my grandfather's life, the rest of my grandfather's life. Crop-Eared Wolf died in 1913.
Yeah,
my grandfather a fair time later.
What I mean, was that unusual that a white person and someone who's Aboriginal having a friendship like that in that era?
No, it turns out that it wasn't. I mean, I know about that friendship, and it was very important to my grandfather,
yeah.
And it was sort of signaled by a gift that Crop-Eared Wolf gave him that I'm going to talk about in a minute. But
yeah.
They were all, the Blackfoot and the settlers, the ranchers especially, were rubbing shoulders with each other all the time. The Blackfoot had come through a devastating time with the collapse of the buffalo herds, the disappearance of the buffalo, which had nourished their sort of material and spiritual nourishment for generations. And so it was very hard times for them. And then with the coming of the settlers, things were changing in other ways as well. They were used to newcomers to their territory. They were skilled at deciding whether they would go to war with them or find some way of getting along with them, and they decided in those circumstances that a peace treaty was better than going to war, and that was the treaty that they signed with Canada in 1877. It's called Treaty 7 because it's one of the numbered treaties on the prairies. And in those, up to that time, and indeed in the years following, there were many, many associations and friendships between the Blackfoot tribe, the individuals in the Blackfoot tribe, and folks like my grandpa. And I mean, one of his other close friends was Big Swan, who was chief of the Piegan, with whom he conspired to publish a newspaper called The Outlaw, a mischievous newspaper that they got in together. So there were all kinds of things that they were doing together, and the ranching brought them together, and the ranching was taken up by the Blackfoot because they were extraordinarily skilled horsemen. They were one of the great horse cultures of the world, in fact.
And I guess one of the lessons throughout the book is just how we should react to one another. And there's a great lesson in here about Jack and Crop-Eared Wolf and how they get along. I mean, I guess that's the motivation to write a book like this.
Well, it was in many ways. Yeah, I mean, I I was looking to the present as much as to the past when I got thinking about the book. My grandfather's story, of course, has been with me all my life. I knew him when I was very young, but I heard his stories all growing up, all through my and throughout my life. But I, you know, looking around these days, it's a time of division and distrust and disrespect on every front, it seems. And this was a time not without its challenges, God knows, especially for the Blackfoot, but also for the ranchers and the settlers who were trying to make a new life for themselves, make a life for themselves. And in the face of daunting circumstances, the year after my grandfather arrived, they had a terrible winter. And the spring, instead of the big roundup as they would usually have, they had what they called the big die-up. Many folks lost half or three-quarters of their herds. That was nothing compared to what was facing the Blackfoot. And indeed, it was, and my grandfather always said this to my mother, it was the example of the Blackfoot, their pride, their sense of purpose, their determination, their recognition that they had to get on with things that inspired many of the settlers. It wasn't the perfect time by any stretch. I mean, this is these were human beings, and there were stresses and conflicts. What there was, though, was a sense of community, a sense that they could do things in a way that fitted with their circumstances and with the conditions that they were living in and with the hopes and ambitions they had for themselves. And what they pushed back against with varying degrees of success was the imposition of ambitions and divisions and things from the East. The political divisions,
yeah.
The people in that territory wanted to have a mode of governance that was nonpartisan, that was shaped by the community. They didn't want the decisions all made in Ottawa, and that, of course, wreaked terrible havoc on the Blackfoot with the Indian agencies and the Indian agents taking instructions from the East and imposing them on the West. The good side was that the North Osmond Police, who had been there from 1874 and who felt themselves part of the community, often did everything they could to counter the actions of the Indian agents.
Yeah.
So there were close friendships between many of the police and many of the Blackfoot as they tried to get on with their lives in circumstances that were complicated and challenging, but held promise.
So what's clear as we've talked these past few minutes, and from what I've read of the book so far, is just how much impact this community had on Jack. Do you have a sense of what Crappier both thought of your grandfather?
Not as much as I wish I did. What I have, though, is a sense that I think I can honestly take from his gift to my grandfather of a ceremonial quirt. It's called a riding crop, carved and painted by Crappier Wolf himself, who was a gifted artist as well as a warrior, telling the story of his life as a warrior, his life as a gatherer of horses, one of the great horsemen of his time, and as a statesman and leader. And is that, in a sense, it was a tribute to their friendship. I won't say a tribute to my grandfather so much as a tribute, though I think it was, but I think a tribute to the importance of friendship. It was the friendship between Red Crow and James McLeod. James McLeod, both the head of the North Osmond Police, but also a commissioner of Treaty 7, and Red Crow, one of the people who negotiated Treaty 7. Their friendship made the treaty possible. They both trusted each other. And I think Crappier Wolf's gift was a signal that went beyond his lifetime and went beyond my grandfather's lifetime, that trusting each other, keeping your word, was at the heart of building a sense of community. And to our collective sort of disgrace, Canada didn't keep its word. My grandfather believed, James McLeod believed, many of the people there believed that they were all treaty people too, just like the Blackfoot. They were bound by the treaty. And Canada was bound, should have been bound, to keep the terms of the treaty, but didn't and hasn't. And I think it's now time, it's a good time in for all of the troubles around us to take stock of what we can do as a country and as a community to see ourselves as treaty people and to take and to keep our word, for Canada to keep its word. I should say that that court was both a gift in itself, but it's also it tells a story, of course, as many carvings and paintings in all cultures do, and the book is about stories and storytelling and the need to know something of each other's stories, to see them as often woven together, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to write this book, is the story of my grandfather and Cropper Wolf was woven together, and to learn something about how they take different forms and shapes. And that was a time of stories of all sorts, and one of the things that held me as I was sort of turning to the book was the remarkable characters that there were in that time and place. Among them, of course, Crop-Eared Wolf, Red Crow, the Big Swan, a number of the other Blackfoot who feature in the book, but also some of the settlers.
Well, so it was important for you to tell your grandfather's story and tell the stories of this time and place. Why do you think it is we don't? I mean, why is it that we don't listen to each other and we don't, say, pass on what we need to pass on to future generations? I mean, you say that this is a right time for reconciliation and the sword, and I obviously agree with you, but we have been reticent heretofore. Why is that?
I think it's been, for a while, it's been a kind of nervousness. I mean, this was a time when medicine bundles and Bibles sat side by side, and when there were Blackfoot drums and piano recitals, and there were things that were different, but could be seen as part of the same traditions, and we don't fully recognize. We look on other people's stories as decorative or
foreign,
documentary,
yeah.
or something telling story, but we don't see them as things of craft and beauty the same way we do our stories, whoever we happen to be. And
yeah.
I think recognizing that people need to celebrate their stories in the particular way their stories take shape. And some of the Blackfoot stories take shape in dances and in drummings and in carvings and paintings, as well as in storytelling and song, just as some of our stories do. And we want to recognize the character of those stories, and we don't always find it easy to do so, and we're not always helped to do so.
Yeah,
I'm trying to kind of help this along. You mentioned that I taught literature for a number of years. Mm-hmm. Literature is a kind of upscale name for stories and songs, so I've always sort of thought myself in the business of stories and songs as much as of what we call literature.
So this is a personal story for you because it's your grandfather, obviously. What have other family relations thought of this book and this being out there now for a wider audience?
Well, we'll see. Some of them just know I've been working on it and haven't seen the book. I didn't pass it by anyone for vetting, either in the family or specifically in the, you know, from on the history side or from the Blackfoot community. But I spent a long time. Well, I spent in some ways much of my life thinking about this and working on this, and in the past few years, 3 years, doing nothing else. I hope they'll be proud of my grandfather and the family. I hope they'll also be proud of what he was part of and the community he was part of, apart from the things he did and the kind of way in which he, in his commitment to that community represented something that was very important. My grandfather, as the title suggests, he started a small private bank in McLeod just about a year after he got there. He didn't have a lot of money, but he did have a sense, he knew, he could tell, that the ranchers, the cowboys, all needed someone to help with cash flow. And the folks who were starting businesses there or setting up homes there needed someone to help them do that. And he always used to say that credit, which is what banks offer, means simply, I believe, he believes or she believes. And he believed in that place. He, and everyone has said this widely on the historian side, he was a major part of the success of ranching in the community, but also a major part, I think, of helping folks, and he was helped by folks in the sense that they were all in it together, and they could make this something different. And it didn't turn out the way many of them had hoped, and mm-hmm. the breakup of the territory, of Blackfoot territory, if you want, and I want to call it that, into Alberta and Saskatchewan, shifted the center of authority to the east. While many of them wanted to establish a single territory, and one of the most eloquent of those who did was the premier of the Northwest Territories, a man named Fred Haltane, one of my grandpa's friends from Fort McLeod, and he proposed a single territory, nonpartisan governance, and to call it Buffalo, after in tribute to the buffalo had been so important to the Blackfoot and to the natural history of the place, as well as to the kind of human history of the buffalo. And the sense that isn't always recognized is how deeply that sense of the uniqueness of this community, and indeed of all communities in Canada, was at the time. Out west there. My grandpa went back to Regina in 1885, just after he'd arrived in McLeod, to support Louis Riel at his trial, because he felt that Riel's idea of a new kind of governance was the right one, even though he may not have agreed with all his methods, but he and lots of others did too.
You know, there's much to admire about your grandfather, and I'm curious to know what of him is most prominent in your own life that you're like him, if you will. I mean, is there something about him that you're most like?
It could be the mischievousness. I'd like to think something of that, but it's, I don't know, I guess it's a sense of a, I do believe in the future of this country, and I do believe that we can do a hell of a lot better than we have been doing working out ways of respecting the First Nations and finding a way of seeing this as a new kind of commonwealth. And I mean that in the broadest sense, a new kind of shared commitment to our separate sense of communities. And they need to be separate because we need to hold on, each of us, to the different heritages that are shape us and that show us who we are and where we belong. And it's that sense of, it may be that sense of trying to find ways not of so much of bridging the gap, but of respecting the differences that we can do better at. And one of the things that everyone who remembers him on the reminiscence and the history side says about him is that he always kept his word, and he expected other people to keep their word. And in that time, there was no security for anybody who came to the bank, and he had to trust them to keep their word. And in the 20 years he ran the bank until he sold it in 1905 to the Bank of Commerce, he had almost nobody who failed to keep their word, which is an extraordinary record. And it's to their credit as much as to his credit. It's to the credit of the people there who the only thing they had was their good word. And the only thing Canada has is its good word, and it's failed. in that to its First Nations, and to the Métis and to the Inuit as well.
Yeah. Well, you've done a great service in the course of writing this book, and I can't wait to finish it, as I told you before we started. But beyond that, I can't wait for people to read this and get the various lessons out of it that we need at this time.
Well, thanks, and I hope when they do turn to it that they get some fun out of it as well, out of the sitting in the bar of the McLeod Hotel, and down along the bar there's a fellow named Harry Longabaugh who became better known as the Sundance Kid a little later in his life, and another fellow called Francis Dickens, who was Charles Dickens' son, and a range of other folks like John Ware, who is a black rancher, one of the most revered, respected of the ranchers in the community, who and was also one of the best rodeo cowboys. And if I can just kind of finish with a story that always kind of catches something of the promise there. In the 1912 Calgary Stampede, which was the first of the Calgary Stampedes, the winner of the Bronco competition was a Blood Indian, Tom Three Persons. So the world champion cowboy was an Indian, which seems to me to catch something of what was happening then. And there's a picture that I have in the book extraordinary picture of a group of people sitting in a Packard 30 touring car in 1912 at the Stampede. And the people are a man named Malcolm McKenzie, who was the provincial treasurer of the new province of Alberta. Next to him is a man, Leans Over Butchering, who is the Piegan chief. In the seat right behind him is a man named Ned Monsell, who was a rancher and was a partner of my grandfather when my grandfather went into ranching after he'd sold the bank. And next to him is Bull Plume, who was one of the traditional Piegan elders and chiefs. And behind them are three Piegan. And here they are, the Blackfoot and the settlers kind of heading into the 21st century in the same car with all of the sense of promise and uncertainty that it holds. And I think we've got to go back to that sense of heading into the future together.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is a great way to start. And I appreciate your time today, Ted. Good luck with this book.
Thank you very much, Joe.
The book is called The Banker and the Blackfoot, a memoir of my grandfather in Chinook Country. It's published by Knopf. Do pick it up. As I said in the introduction, I've started it, and can't wait to get back to it. It's author J. Edward Chamberlain. Join me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.